From KCRW, this is Left, Right, and Center.
The 2020 Democratic campaign has begun in earnest. Can Beto O'Rourke ride tables and countertops all the way to the presidency? Is mayor of South Bend a sufficient resume item to run for president? Who the hell is Andrew Yang? And should Joe Biden pick a running mate right when he announces his campaign? We will discuss all that and more today on Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow. Later in the show, Texas is turning purple and the state's Republican Party is finally waking up to that. Houston Chronicle columnist Erica Greider will tell us about Democratic hopes to gain even more ground in the state next year and what Republicans are doing to cement their control where they've been in charge for over two decades. California Governor Gavin Newsom has suspended his state's death penalty. Is that the right move? And Democrats hate the Electoral College, but is it worth their time to push to abolish it? All that plus the Theranos fraud is coming up next on Left, Right, and Center. We'll be right back. If you're listening to our show, you're probably someone who appreciates all sides of an argument. So there's another podcast we think you should check out, Intelligence Squared US. America's leading debate series, they bring the most influential thinkers like David Brooks, Arianna Huffington, and Deepak Chopra together to debate contentious topics like free speech, the environment, and religion. It's not about soundbites and pundits, but a thoughtful, spirited competition of ideas. Find Intelligence Squared US wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome back to Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow, your center and business columnist at New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunick, columnist at The Washington Post. The 2020 presidential campaign seems to have begun in earnest, and even what you might call minor candidates are getting their days in the sun. Of course, you have frontrunners like Bernie Sanders and Kamala Harris, and Joe Biden, should he choose to enter the race. You also have millennial South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg and entrepreneur Andrew Yang, neither of whom has the traditional resume of a presidential candidate, but they both received donations from over 65,000 individual donors, which qualifies them to be on the stage at the first debate sponsored by the Democratic National Committee. Buttigieg had a well-received CNN town hall. Yang has told the Daily Beast he agrees with intactivists who oppose circumcision. And then there's former Congressman Beto O'Rourke. He's been standing on countertops across America, and he faked out the media by declining to announce his campaign's first-day fundraising total. That refusal produced speculation. Was his fundraising weak? Had the Beto fad faded? Then, boom, he announced he'd raised $6.1 million on his first day running for president, outstripping even Bernie Sanders. Today, we're going to take a look at this broadening field, and to do so, we're joined by Erica Greider, who is Metro columnist at the Houston Chronicle. Hello, Erica. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Josh. Thanks for having me on.
So, Beto is polarizing. People are awed by his charisma. They think he's an empty suit. They think he's the next Obama. They think he's trying way too hard to be cool. What does Beto look like from the ground level?
Well, it's been interesting because, as you know, Beto ran for Senate in Texas in the 2018 cycle against Ted Cruz and narrowly lost that race. It was about
got a little bit of national press.
Right. I've noticed. But, you know, it's funny because for Texas, of course, you know, Texans have been through now a sort of a full 2-year Beto cycle, right? So now we're watching Americans go through the 2-year Beto cycle. And so there's things that, you know, having seen the Senate campaign, which, of course, got a lot of national press, for example, this like standing on tables thing, right? I mean, Beto stands on tables. He has stood on tables all over the state of Texas for the past 2 years. So that's been sort of a flap in the past couple of days. I guess it sort of speaks to his informality, perhaps, his the charisma you mentioned. But it's also seen as a bit uncouth, perhaps, to stand on tables. I think that occasioned no commentary whatsoever during the Senate race, his habit of standing on tables. So, you know, certainly I think he enters the race as a strong candidate. He has, I think, you know, a certain... an appeal to people who want an outsider, who want somebody authentic, want somebody challenging the status quo. He certainly has fans across the country because of the Senate race, which got so much attention. But in this case, you know, that was a Senate race against one vulnerable incumbent, Ted Cruz. Now he's in a crowded field. I mean, there's 16, 17 at least. I mean, serious candidates we're all tracking for the Democratic nomination. And many of them have compelling attributes and credentials, some of which overlap with Beto's compelling attributes and credentials.
Liz, it's funny to me because so much of that stuff is so amorphous. I mean, the idea of an outsider, somebody shaking up the status quo, I think a lot of the Democratic candidates would lay claim to being outsiders. I think all of them would claim that they intend to shake up the status quo. And yet the appeal of this is undeniable. I mean, he beat your guy on fundraising.
I mean, on the first 24 hours, right? I mean, I think that there are a lot of things that Beto has going for him. And I would say that probably the main one is not that he's an outsider. I think the main thing Beto has going for him, especially with sort of mainstream Democrats, is that he seems like a reincarnation of Obama. Even the speaking style, the sort of way he carries himself, just sort of gestures and general demeanor, and the fact that, you know, at least on a high frequency, very public level, he has sort of declined to commit to a lot of the left priorities that the progressive wing of the party is putting forward. So I think that it's actually the fact that he seems like a very mainstream Democrat of a recent vintage is what's appealing.
Liz, you're a supporter of Senator Sanders, who I don't know as well, but is the concern that the left has with Beto that he's not ideologically reliable enough?
Just that he's not as far left. Right? I think he's completely reliable in his lane. But, you know, he said he's not really for Medicare for All. And a lot of these left priorities that we've put forward, you know, debt-free four-year college and free community college. But there's a lot of sort of qualifying and pruning back of sort of left priorities like that that just signal that he's not lying to anyone. He's just not a left guy. He has said explicitly he doesn't identify with the sort of Democratic Socialist wing of the party.
Interesting.
Rich, I mean, one thing it feels like Republicans have been counting on is that that Democrats are going to overreach in this election. There's a sense that Democrats have decided they need to get as far to the left as possible to win the nomination. Republicans think that will be a liability against Donald Trump in a general election. You've talked before about the personal charisma and appeal that Beto has. When you combine that with the fact that he's clearly entered this race with an intention not to get as far to the left as he could, does that scare you about Beto as a general election candidate?
Yeah, quite possibly. Look, I think the whole phenomenon is preposterous, but I say this mindful of the fact that two out of the two last presidential candidates who I thought were building a ridiculous cult of personality became president of the United States, Barack Obama and Donald Trump. And there's no substitute, unfortunately, for looks and charisma in politics, and there never has been. John Adams said somewhat unfairly that George Washington was selected to lead everything because he was a foot taller than everyone else in the room at the time of our founding. So there's just something compelling. You know, I've watched, I don't know how many of these photos I've looked at of him standing on countertops at coffee shops. He did this video that was completely ridiculous, where he stopped his minivan or whatever he drives around at a gas station as he was filling up, and you could see the, you know, the dollar amount going up, and it was like, you know, look, I need this $28.75 to stay on the road. At the same time, he's raising millions of dollars. He's pretending he needs to scrounge for gas money, but it kind of works. And substantively, he's adopting the Lowry plan. I don't know whether that's a good idea in a Democratic primary, but this is the approach I would suggest. Say you're in favor of these rubrics, you know, and he's in favor of all the top line ideas while not endorsing the substance, which is could actually be a killer in the general election. And maybe if the shoe were on the other foot, I'd be where Liz is and just want to try to elect an ideological purist. But I would think the play for the Democrats, nominate the most electable candidate, as you can reasonably determine that, elect him or her, and then push him or her to the left when this person is president of the United States.
So the funny thing is, Beto is not the only Texas candidate in this Democratic presidential nominating race. You also have Julian Castro, who's a former mayor of San Antonio, former secretary of housing and urban development, and obviously has gotten a lot less national attention. Erica, what is the view on Castro from Texas? Is he getting a lot of traction as well?
You know, he's getting not as much media attention as Beto is even in Texas, but he is getting traction in the sense that I think he's, especially in San Antonio where I'm from, he's taken very seriously as a leader. He was the mayor of that city and on city council prior to that. His brother, Joaquin Castro, is a U.S. rep from San Antonio. Prior to that, served in the legislature. So the family is well-known in San Antonio. They have a long record of getting things done. I mean, as mayor, we've had discussions about other mayors, former mayors and current mayors who are now in the race, including John Hickenlooper, of former mayor of Denver, and Pete Buttigieg, who you mentioned, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. And they all three have spoken to the fact that as a mayor, you have to deliver results, right? You're really on the ground. You have to, you know, hear concerns about things like from education to business development to potholes and bike lanes. And so I think that certainly the credentials that Julian has, Mayor Castro has, as a former mayor of one of the country's largest cities, are easier to, they're more well understood here in Texas, and they're taken more seriously as a result.
Liz, you're also from Texas. What do you make of Castro as a candidate? Does he meet your left tests?
Well, again, it's very early for Castro. There are some complaints about how he performed when he was running HUD for Obama. I think that he has come out, you know, pretty far left in a vocal way on some issues. So right now the Democrats are kind of having this debate over reparations. And Castro has been very firm and very emphatic about his support for reparations, which I think has been impressive to a lot of folks on the left. But otherwise, there's just a lot of blanks that need filling in to understand him as a candidate.
Can we talk about Andrew Yang?
Yes.
First, I think we need to explain who Andrew Yang is. I mean, Erica, you devoted a column this month to Andrew Yang.
Did.
So can you explain Andrew Yang to a public who might not be extremely online?
I can
and
certainly
might not know
try.
Who this person is, who will be on the Democratic debate stage.
He will be. He is an extremely online entrepreneur by background. He is the founder of Venture for America, which is sort of modeled after Teach for America. So it's sort of in different cities across the country, and it supports, provides seed capital for sort of small business startup owners. And so he's this guy who decided, and he filed to run for president very early on, I think January 2017, maybe. I mean, it was before anybody else got in the race. And he's been sort of going around the country building this sort of presence. He has a lot of support from the unsavory quarters of the extremely online world. So a lot of support on 4chan, on Reddit, for example. But, you know, he's kind of coming from a sort of orthogonal point of view on policy debates. He's never run for any office before, much less president. And he's qualified for the Democratic debate stage by eliciting more than 65,000 donations from individual donors, one of whom was me. I saw him speak in Houston and was like, you know, this guy has got such a sort of different perspective on these debates. I mean, he's coming at it as an entrepreneur, talking about how he saw, you know, over the years, what automation had done to disrupt, you know, the Rust Belt states in particular. And he's thinking about that as a trend that will continue and will continue to have sweeping implications that we're not even, you know, as a country dealing with or even ready to deal with, because we're not talking about that kind of conversation. So he's got, you know, this policy agenda. You can look at his website, and his sort of signature has been a proposal for a universal basic income in conjunction with a digital social credits kind of time banking scheme. So you would earn credits for volunteering for civic activities. And in his, you know, framework, you'd also get $1,000 a month as a quote unquote freedom dividend. But then beyond that, his policy ideas, I mean, run the gamut. I'm sure we'll, you know, all, we're about to have a debate, I guess, about his views on circumcision or against circumcision.
Are
he's
we?
Debate that.
I'm not sure, well, we have to have that debate.
We are not, per se. But
he's debating Ben Shapiro on it.
Right. It's like Ben Shapiro just challenges everyone to debates about everything, right? And so, you know, Andrew Yang accepts. And so that'll be coming up soon. I don't know if it's scheduled yet.
Liz, I'm interested to know what you make of this guy, because he describes himself very much as a capitalist. He's advocating for the next phase of capitalism, for human capitalism. But a lot of his agenda seems to be built around what I think you could call decommodification of the economy. He's trying to sort of de-emphasize labor for wages. Part of that is this universal basic income that would give workers more power to decline jobs that pay poorly. He has this idea about what he calls digital social credits for activity in the economy that is unpaid. He wants to emphasize economic measures besides GDP that try to understand the whole of the human existence rather than just valuable production in the economy. What do you make of that idea set?
Well, I would say that there's always been a thread in sort of contemporary pro-capitalist ideology that has been especially fond of, you know, for instance, the UBI. So there's a reason you hear universal
basic
income.
That's the universal basic income.
Right. And there's a reason you hear it discussed favorably at sort of Davos and, you know, by the Aspen Institute and all of these other organizations that are pretty powerfully pro-capitalist, both in theory and practice. And that is that you can see it as being a measure, especially if combined with other proposals like eliminating outside welfare programs that would, A, sort of streamline and cheapen the welfare state, but also kind of take down a little bit of the swelling that leads people to criticize capitalism and vote for powerfully anti-capitalist policies. So it's one of those measures that can actually, and you can sort of look at some of the New Deal programs in a similar light, preserve capitalism by taking out some of the reaction to it that comes from people who are very badly disadvantaged by it. And I think that Yang probably fits in that tradition.
Rich, what do you make of this guy?
Not a lot. He's interesting. I think the most important and worthy proposal probably is his proposed crackdown on robocall companies that make us all miserable. But I'm not a fan of universal basic income. I think it's a very bad idea to pay people for not working. And if we're concerned about the plight of the working class in the new economy, as we should be, you should be looking at a wage subsidy, but, you know, which is subsidizing actual work, which you want to encourage. But, you know, this guy, he's got, you know, an online following it, following, not all of it very savory. One of my colleagues who was trolled endlessly in 2016 from kind of Russian bots and alt-right types has gone back and looked at a lot of these accounts, and some significant percentage of them now are Andrew Yang supporters for whatever reason.
Do we have a thought on why that would be?
Yes.
As Rich notes, his policies are sort of a grab bag. There's one that I like, yeah. Which is that he says that government regulators should be paid a lot more. They should be paid comparably with executives in the industries that they regulate. And then in exchange for that, they should be prohibited from ever going to work in those industries. So it seems to me like there's a mix of big pie in the sky ideas, small common sense ideas. Why would this be of interest to sort of the 4chan community?
Well, Liz? Because they're nihilists, right? So they have... There are a couple of things. They're intensely irony inflected, and they're also super nihilistic. And so the 4chan Pepe perspective at this point is that Trump was kind of a letdown, that he turned out to be much more interested in, other things than what they had hoped he would be interested in, that he hasn't built a wall and so on and so forth, and that he's been co-opted in some respects by the GOP establishment. I know that probably mainstream GOPers would disagree with that, but that's how they feel because they had very radical expectations. And so they have this narrative of just sort of checking out of politics and enjoying the decline of Western civilization. And so their argument is, look, Yang's going to give me $1,000 a month to check out, post on the internet, and watch everything collapse. And that is the argument coming out of this sort of irony nihilist right for Andrew Yang. And they like the hats.
Let's take a quick break. We've got more candidates to talk about. We'll come back. We'll talk about Mayor Pete Buttigieg. We'll talk about Joe Biden. I've been talking with Rich Lowry of National Review, Elizabeth Brunig of The Washington Post, and Erica Greider of The Houston Chronicle. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at The Washington Post. And Erica Greider of The Houston Chronicle is also with us. Former Vice President Joe Biden is not yet running for president, though he leads a lot of the public polls for the Democratic nomination. And this week we've seen a couple of trial balloons. What if Biden announced he'd only serve one term? What if he announced right away that his running mate would be former Georgia gubernatorial nominee Stacey Abrams? Does anyone want to stick up for either of these ideas as making sense for the launch of a Biden for president campaign?
I don't. Usually it's a bad sign that when you're thinking about gimmicks out of the gate. And I think both of these kind of hang a lantern on his problems rather than solving them. And he has to appeal to the party as it exists today on his own. I mean, no one else is going to be able to do it for him. It doesn't matter who his presumptive running mate would be. So I go back and forth on Biden. I can very much see him as kind of the Jeb Bush who notionally leads in the polls because he's well known. And then once he gets in the race, just sinks and sinks and sinks because he's out of step with the party and a little bit out of practice. On the other hand, you know, I see him, maybe I'm too conventional, as the strongest candidate against Trump. And there may be just a crucial increment of Democratic voters who just want to beat this guy and see Biden willing to do that. We forget, you know, despite all the attention AOC and others get in the House, there are a lot of moderates in the House that won in relatively tough districts and they won primary battles and actually got nominated. So those Democratic primary voters are still out there.
See, I want to stick up for this idea, or at least for the Stacey Abrams part. I think a one-term pledge is dumb. I think you're promising to be a lame duck. It makes you weak once you get in there. Immediately, people start conspiring about how they're going to succeed you. I think that's a bad idea. I think that Stacey Abrams getting on his ticket right away would actually make a fair amount of sense for both of them. I think, first of all, people think of this as a gimmick or a ploy because that's the way it's been used in the past. You had Ted Cruz, who was about to lose a presidential campaign, doing this as a Hail Mary, and he looked desperate because he was desperate. I think if you come right out of the gate, you're able to say, look, here's a fuller picture of the kind of presidency I would bring you. Here's the team we're going to have, and they cover a lot of bases for each other, black and white, old and young, geographic diversity, appeals to very different constituencies in the party, moderates and progressives. And so I think they could make a case that basically they have a lot more to bring together than either of them would separately. I also think Abrams is in a weird position politically where she's this big national rising star. She came close to winning this election in Georgia. It's not obvious what she should do next. She could run for Senate, and Georgia is a purpling state, but it is still a red state. She would probably lose that Senate race if she ran it, though she might might win it. And so I think if she got on this ticket, it would give her a very good chance of becoming vice president and therefore a very good chance of becoming president. So I think it makes a lot of sense politically for her. And I think she really would shore up a lot of Joe Biden's weaknesses and pair them with significant strengths that he does have. Liz or Erica, what do you make of that pitch?
I mean, I would contest the idea that it doesn't look desperate. As you say, Cruz was desperate. That's why he suggested Carly Fiorina would be his running mate, and they had that announcement. And to me, this feels the same way. It seems like a gimmick that points to what Biden sees as his obvious weaknesses in the campaign. It feels like an effort, in a sense, to subvert the Democratic primary process, which, you know, I think Democrats are going to bridle at, especially after the 2016 cycle, when they felt that Hillary Clinton had effectively done that to Senator Sanders. And, you know, I mean, as it's unfortunate for Stacey Abrams, who almost won the gubernatorial race in Georgia, or arguably did win it, depending on, you know, who you talk to, that she's in the position now of being in a reddish, purpling state without a kind of clear next step to do. But I don't see that. I think it would be an asset for Biden to have her on the ticket, but I think it for her to agree to that, it just seems like a strange plan in a way to sort of stifle the full and free debate that the Democratic candidates are going to be having over the next year.
I mean, I think it's a better proposition for Biden than Abrams by a long shot. I mean, I agree with Rich that there's a lot of polling that suggests that Biden is a pretty, strong candidate, at least at this point. My concern would be that once he gets into the race, there's going to be a lot of questions raised about past behavior, not only legislative, but other types of conduct that you've already seen people making some noise about. And Abrams, at this point, is a rising star. I wouldn't want to see her sort of get caught up in all that. I would be sort of disturbed to see that unfold. And so that's why I would think, you know, if I were Biden, this would seem like a great proposition. If I were Abrams, I would probably be thinking carefully.
Can we talk about Mayor Pete Buttigieg, mayor of South Bend, Indiana, population 102,000, he ran for chairman of the Democratic National Committee, did not get a lot of traction in that race, then turned around and ran for president. And I think people initially looked at this and thought it was sort of odd, the mayor of such a small city running for president. He's gotten a lot of attention over the last few weeks. And I feel like I'm in a bubble. I don't know quite how to evaluate it because I'm also a guy in my mid-30s who's gay and who graduated from Harvard in the mid-2000s. I didn't actually know Pete in college, but I knew a ton of people who knew him. And in my own circle, I'm seeing a lot of enthusiasm for this. It is probably like the least representative circle possible. but on the other hand, he did have this CNN town hall that was very well received, that generated all these individual donations to him that will also get him on the debate stage. And he's in a way been talking very big about some issues that you don't usually see in presidential campaigns. He's big out there on, you know, abolish the Electoral College, pack the court, although he has a very unusual court plan that would require a constitutional amendment. He wants 5 Republican judges and 5 Democratic judges, and then they have to agree unanimously on another 5 judges to sit in the middle of the court. What do we make of this pitch for the first millennial president?
Well, I mean, to your point, Josh, I've heard a lot about him also dating back to 2017 when he ran for chair of the Democratic National Committee. And I heard from friends, you know, who were just spontaneously impressed by his candidacy. This guy's, you know, a rising star. He's the mayor of a small town. So nobody, I think I heard about him from friends who didn't know anything about his record, who weren't Harvard alumni, who were just impressed by his presence, his thoughtfulness, his clarity, his wonkishness. And I've heard good things about him, too, from friends who were kind of spectators in the race thus far. So, yeah, I mean, it does seem unlikely just given his age. He's our age, right? I mean, he's, but, you know, he's certainly presented himself well and thoughtfully. You mentioned the Supreme Court plan. I mean, it's a well-considered plan. It's not just a sort of a line in a stump speech. He's kind of thought through what it would actually entail, how you would actually accomplish it. It would be a heavy lift because it would require a constitutional amendment. But I think that degree of thoughtfulness and precision is appealing.
Some of this broadening of the field is a reaction to Donald Trump, right? It's a lot of people looked at this and said, well, if this guy can be president, then I can be president, or I can be for whoever I feel like ought to be president. Is that a healthy impulse or an unhealthy one?
Experience just doesn't matter anymore, I don't think, in presidential politics. It was kind of true with Obama, although he had much more political experience compared to Donald Trump. Donald Trump had none. Yeah, so why not? And, you know, he's gotten positive attention, and he's, I think, a good example of just the benefits of running for president if you're fairly sure-footed, and he is. You know, he's winsome, he's smart, he's well-spoken. you know, you can increase your enhance your reputation, but to really like break through when you have, you know, a number of candidates who have much more, much higher profiles and established brands and much more fundraising ability, you have to really, it's not just like people have to watch you on Morning Joe and say, oh, that's an impressive guy. You have to light people on fire. And I don't see him doing that.
Well, and what Buttigieg says about this experience issue is, you know, look, I have more political experience than Donald Trump had when he was elected president. I have more experience as a political executive than Mike Pence had when he was elected vice president. I mean, Liz, you look at this. I mean, Bernie Sanders started his political career as a small city mayor, and look where he is now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Buttigieg is a very interesting candidate, one that I'm certainly curious about. You know, there are some, I think, conflicting reports out of South Bend about, you know, how he actually functioned as a mayor, but that's pretty typical of any campaign. I think he gives really good answers. I think he's a very curious person. I think that's a really good sign. The problem with being a candidate who lights people on fire and invigorates and inspires them is that's like every single person running in the Democratic primary, right? So they, because that's become such an important metric, they all bring that to the table. You know, they have inspiring stories and they have inspiring personas and they have intense personal charisma or some kind of secret sauce. And so that can get drowned out pretty quick this time around.
I do want to turn and talk some more specifically about Texas. It is okay. Still a red state, but not as red as it used to be.
It when is a swing Beto state O'Rourke, for 2020.
Yes. Well, let's talk on. About that. I mean, because when Beto came within about 2.5 points of unseating Ted Cruz last November, Democrats right. beat two Republican House incumbents. They came close in five other House seats. They also picked up about a dozen seats in the state legislature. And in 2017 and 2018, the Republicans who were running the Texas state government had devoted a lot of attention to really divisive social issues, especially a so-called bathroom bill, which was intended right. to prevent transgender people from using restrooms that align with their gender expression. Erica, my sense so far is that Republicans seem to have taken a little bit of a lesson from those election results and that they're trying to be less controversial to hold on to their grip in Texas?
They have. It's been wild to observe. I mean, frankly, I've been here in the state for about 10 years doing politics intermittently. And, you know, in the 18 cycle, I was going around the whole time saying, look, the state is like, people are really angry. I was talking to voters, listening to voters. And it was just, I'm hearing Republican voters who are sort of stalwart Republican voters. Not only am I hearing from Democrats who are very fired up and excited about Beto and excited about their congressional candidates and down ballot candidates, but I'm hearing from like disaffected Republicans who are used to a party that's focused on infrastructure, public education, sort of bread and butter, mainstream issues, business development. And they are so angry about things like the bathroom bill, about just sort of the rhetoric, the theater, the fact that the party's been so supportive of Donald Trump, even though Trump's agenda is so sort of, it has such adverse impacts on Texas in particular. And so what we saw was a genuine purpling of the state. It wasn't just Beto's race. There were four statewide races where the Democrats came within 5 points. There were, as you mentioned, the two congressional pickups. And, you know, at least five more that were within single digits. I mean, actually, I think it was like nine more that were under 6 points. So those can all be in play again this cycle. Democrats are looking at retaking the House. And so I think Republicans, I was surprised they took this lesson because they did win all the races again. But they seem to have woken up on the 7th like, oh, shoot, you know, the quality of our candidates actually matters. What we do in the legislature actually matters. And so they have been thus far in the current legislative session, you know, more temperate than usual. It's been wild.
Yeah, so Liz, when people talk about Texas turning blue or at least turning purple, what do you see as driving that? Is that about an electorate that's getting more progressive, or is it about a reaction against a Republican Party that has alienated the moderate part of the electorate?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's about demographic changes in Texas. I think it's about the sort of overwhelming sweep of younger people towards the left. I think that there are a lot of people who live in Texas who are not actually from Texas. It's a great attractor of out-of-state immigration. I think that Texas is increasingly urban, so you see sort of more typical urban politics coming out of that. I mean, I think it's multifarious. There are a lot of reasons that you're seeing Texas sort of tip in a way that, I mean, to be fair, it has in the past, but under a very different Democratic regime than it's been Democratic before.
Rich, Erica talks there about Republicans at the state level adjusting to a new political reality. I don't think we're seeing that with federal Republican office holders from Texas. When I look at voting records coming out of the House and who's trying to build a record showing independence from Donald Trump, you see a lot of these members from the Rust Belt, Brian Fitzpatrick outside Philadelphia, people like Fred Upton in Western Michigan. These Republicans who used to have safe districts in Texas, who now have pretty vulnerable districts in Texas, still are voting like red state members. They don't seem to be recognizing a political geography shifting under them. Is something going to catch Republicans places like this? Also, you know, things like the Atlanta suburbs where, you know, you used to have a really conservative district. You don't anymore. You have to adjust or lose.
Yeah, I think it's just it still blows people's minds that Texas might not be reliable ruby red state anymore. And it's largely, I think, driven by demographics and the urbanization of the state. And the cities have become bluer. The populous suburbs are becoming purplish, and the red areas, the rural areas, are becoming emptier. So that's just a big challenge. And if Texas, you know, is ever really reaches the tipping point, it just shows the party's future has to be, you know, where Trump won in 2016. You need to have reliable appeal in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, places like that, to make up for it on the electoral map.
Erica, you say Texas as a swing state for 2020. There's a Senate race there. John Cornyn is going to run for re-election. A lot of people have urged that Beto O'Rourke ought to be running for Senate instead of running for president because he came close last time and could win this time. What does the outlook look like for that Senate race to you, especially if Beto doesn't run? Do Democrats have a strong candidate to put up against John Cornyn?
I think they are likely to have a strong candidate, probably Joaquin Castro, the U.S. rep from San Antonio, who I mentioned before. He's looked at the Senate race in the past. He's been in Congress, so he's interested in federal government. He has a very relevant portfolio in Congress at the moment. I mean, he was the author of the resolution against the emergency declaration just last week. And John Cornyn, I think it should be noted, is not as vulnerable probably as Cruz was. But I think that, you know, in this cycle, I mean, But both Rich and Liz mentioned demographics, and that's true. I mean, especially younger Texans, you know, are leaning heavily Democratic, and it's a very young state. So every year you get more voters coming into the electorate who are who skew Democratic. But Texas is about 80% urbanized. That's been true for a decade at least. It's been a majority minority state for a decade at least. So it's not just demographics. I mean, it's not just domestic migration. Actually, a lot of domestic migrants to Texas skew Republican. Beto, if you look back at the 18 race, won a majority of people of Texas voters who were born in Texas. So I think that really what we're seeing is that the party is losing support. And so John Cornyn, although he's not as personally vulnerable as Ted Cruz or as Donald Trump, who will be the top of the ticket, we assume, in 2020, he's still associated with this party that people have really just are really just frustrated by. I don't know if they've turned against it permanently, but certainly at the moment, there is a sense among the conservatives I talk to, they're frustrated. I mean, they've really had it for the time being.
I sort of feel like a lot of what's happening in Texas is just an example of what's happening around the country, which is to say that Republicans continue to make more and more inroads with non-college educated white voters, especially in rural areas and small cities, and Democrats continue to make more and more inroads in the suburbs, especially affluent suburbs. And the thing is that Texas just didn't have a lot of non-college educated white voters who were still voting Democratic. Like, Republicans had mopped up almost all the votes they could within that demographic, unlike in states like Iowa, where there was still a lot of support for them to gain, whereas there is a ton of support for Republicans to lose in Texas in the suburbs of Dallas and Houston and San Antonio. And that, I think, is the ugly demographic story for Republicans, that they've run out of upside, and there's still a whole lot of downside waiting for them in the state.
They've outkicked their coverage, I think, and you're right. And there's not a lot of white working class voters in Texas either. The working class in Texas is really black and brown working class voters.
We're going to have to leave that there on Texas. Erica Greider, Metro columnist for the Houston Chronicle, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's take a quick break. I will be back with Liz Brunig of The Washington Post and Rich Lowry of National Review to talk about the death penalty, the Electoral College, and the death penalty for the Electoral College. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunick, columnist at The Washington Post. California Governor Gavin Newsom has suspended death penalty executions in his state. If made permanent, this would be part of a trend. 8 states have abolished the death penalty since 2007, and lawmakers in New Hampshire are considering making their state the 9th. Public support for capital punishment is also declining. Last year, the Pew Research Center found 54% of Americans favored the death penalty for murder, which is a decline from 78% support in 1996. Rich, what do you think is behind this sharp decline in support for death penalty? It still has a bare majority, but way less support than it had 20-plus years ago.
It might be some of the work the Innocence Project has done, where we've seen people that it seemed to be just a lockdown cinch case that they're guilty. And then when you do the DNA test, it emerges that they weren't. And there might have been various abuses involved. In terms of what Newsom did, I just think the process is terrible and abusive. His commutation power is supposed to be used in a case-by-case basis. It's not meant to kind of vitiate the state's laws in this way. And as recently as 2016, California voted on this issue and voted to retain the death penalty. So if they want to change it, there should be another referendum. There should be a law passed, but the governor just shouldn't be able to do it on his own. It's a version of the same thing that Trump has done with his national emergency declaration.
Liz, what do you make of that? Is Rich right that there's a rule of law argument that this should be continued even over Gavin Newsom's judgment that the death penalty is unjust?
I mean, there's definitely a popular sovereignty argument to be made for it. Usually the limits of those popular sovereignty arguments do center on sort of inalienable human rights. And I think with the death penalty, we're getting to a point nationally where it's beginning to seem more and more, and not just to liberals, but also to several conservative legislatures, New Hampshire, for example, recently, to be a matter of human rights and to actually contravene the Constitution's position on cruel and unusual punishment. Even though federally that hasn't come down yet, I think that's becoming a more and more accepted opinion. So I can see a debate in the California case.
So I think there's sort of two sets of arguments against the death penalty. There's a broad argument that the death penalty is inherently unjust, and then there are also arguments that it's unjust as applied, that basically state governments make too many errors in administering the death penalty, and therefore it's unjust the way we do it in the United States. It might be impossible for states to do it in a just manner. And then you also have concerns about that it takes so long to pursue a death penalty case and is so expensive that it might not be effective as public policy, even if it were just to do. Rich, what do you make of those arguments? Has the death penalty's time passed in the United States?
Well, those two things, two problems are related because you're so fearful of making getting it wrong that you stretch out the appeals process forever and becomes kind of ridiculous. I'm not an opponent of the death penalty. I'm not quite there yet, but I'm not an enthusiast for it. And there are most arguments that are made for abolishing it, I'll kind of nod around along with. But I just still think there's some cases of acts that are so heinous that it's the only appropriate and just punishment. You take Timothy McVeigh, for instance, no doubt about his punishment. And what he did was so horrific and cruel. Is it really just have him just sit in a prison for 40 years watching TV and reading books and doing whatever he wants to do? So that's the case that prevents me from flipping entirely against it.
Well, Liz, this was Hillary Clinton's position in 2016 running for president. She was opposed to state death penalties. She was in favor of the federal death penalty, which has been used extremely rarely. The law expanding the federal death penalty in the 1990s, there have only been 3 federal executions, one of which was of Tim McVeigh. I think there's a case to be made that the federal government overcame a lot of those as-applied moral objections to the death penalty. I don't think people are that afraid that those 3 executions were of people who were wrongly convicted. But I guess the question is, do the broad concerns about having a government take any human life also argue against even a well-administered death penalty?
I mean, I think that's those are the very limit cases, right, where there's 100% certitude that the person is guilty and that there's 100% certitude that they were of sound mind and the crime was sort of meticulously committed and so forth. McVeigh is the perfect case there. But one thing to consider about McVeigh is he did want to be martyred. He was inspired by the killings at Ruby Ridge and by the Waco conflict of David Koresh. He saw himself as a martyr for patriotism. He waived his own death penalty appeals in hopes of having a sort of highly publicized execution. And in the end, it's what we gave him. I don't know if that's been directly linked to more right-wing radicalization in the vein of McVeigh himself. But even in that case, I would say, all right, so we got rid of this heinous criminal, but did we achieve any greater purpose? I think that McVeigh did not want to sit in prison. for the rest of his life. He was a guy who considered himself a proponent of an almost anarchist level of freedom. So sitting inside a federal prison with no contact in the outside world actually might have been the superior punishment in that case for him. But I mean, I can't speak to the emotions that people feel. He bombed a daycare, essentially. My mom was working at the Fort Worth Federal Building when the Oklahoma Federal Building was bombed. I remember it very well. It's extremely disturbing. These are the kinds of things that make me sympathetic to the emotions that people feel that result in, you know, limited support for the death penalty. But ultimately, I am very sympathetic to the case that you simply can't have the death penalty perfectly administered. I just don't think that's possible.
Rich, I think another thing is that in general, we don't want to build laws around edge cases. If we think that every couple of decades that there's going to be one person that we feel like it's important to have a federal death penalty for, that might not be a good reason to build an entire legal and judicial apparatus around the ability to hand that out occasionally. If a side effect of getting rid of the death penalty was that Timothy McVeigh had to live the rest of his life in prison, it feels like that might be an acceptable side effect for the benefits we would get.
These are all good points. I think Liz makes very good points. That's a very good point. I'm nodding along during a lot of this discussion, but I'm not there yet.
Why don't we talk about the Electoral College, since a lot of Democrats have been talking about the Electoral College. Twice in the last five elections, Republicans have won the Electoral College and the presidency, despite trailing in the popular vote. It also happened a couple of times in the 1800s. Liz, is this the time to be talking about abolishing the Electoral College?
I mean, I think that the talk about abolishing the Electoral College has come from these discrepancies that have happened in the past few decades between the popular vote and the Electoral College vote. I understand why there is some hesitance, especially on the right, to abolishing the Electoral College. But I also would say that the abolition discussion is a product of the type of tension that is produced in a democracy when the popular vote is routinely overruled by another kind of non-popular vote. And I think that that tension is only going to get worse and worse, and the anger and aggravation about it more and more intense the more it happens. So it seems like something's got to give.
Rich, is there an argument for the Electoral College besides path dependency that, you know, it is the system that is prescribed in the Constitution? It's the one that we've used in the past. Why is this the right way to elect a president, to sort of add up the vote in each individual state and assign all or nearly all the electoral votes from that state to the candidate who may have gotten just a bare majority?
Well, I think there are a couple benefits that the founders were cognizant of and were right about. One, it is a nod towards the real role that states are supposed to play in our system. Two, it does require some geographic distribution in your support, which is, I think, is important in terms of widening people's coalitions. I think two benefits that they wouldn't have foreseen and didn't foresee is, one, because they didn't foresee political parties, but it is a buttress to our two-party system, makes it much harder for third-party candidates. And no matter how poisonous you think our politics is now, I think it'd be more poisonous if we had more minor parties rather than two parties that imperfectly at least are trying to build broader national coalitions. And two, it does quarantine voting controversies. And in the case of Bush and Gore, where basically you had a tie, more or less, you know, Gore had half a point more than Bush in 2000.
Yes.
But you could have had these election controversies repeated in locality after locality in a way that would serve to undermine the legitimacy of the system. So it's no doubt if routinely the popular vote winner is losing the election, that's going to be another legitimacy problem. But I would just hesitate to forecast that given prior to 2016, everyone was saying, well, Democrats have an electoral college advantage.
Liz, what do you make of these sorts of logistical concerns? I mean, the idea of a national recount, Rich says, you know, that would undermine the legitimacy of the electoral system. And I can imagine that being an enormous mess if you had the situation that you had in Broward County, Florida in 2000 repeating itself all over the country. On the other hand, I think we've had results that have undermined the legitimacy of the electoral system, both the fact that we've had winners who did not get a plurality of the popular vote, and then also when you have a single state that comes down to a contested result like Florida, that also results in questions about the legitimacy of the system.
Right. I mean, I think the legitimacy of the electoral system in the United States has been compromised on several fronts. I mean, one of them is this discrepancy between the popular vote and the electoral college vote. The other is, you know, the purgation of voters from voter rolls in several states. voter suppression efforts in several states, the difficulty of voting for quite a lot of Americans, especially poorer people. So I think that people are already sort of broadly skeptical about the electoral system. Factor in the broad, you know, widespread paranoia about Russian interference in the election, the hacking of the election. And I think we're already kind of in a delicate space with how much legitimacy we can really expect people to confer upon our electoral system. So, I mean, would giving more weight to the popular vote introduce some problems logistically? You know, yeah, potentially. But I do think it's one way to maybe turn the volume down or let some steam out of this growing dissatisfaction with the electoral system itself.
I think a problem with the Electoral College, and I think this is something that Republicans and Democrats should equally see as a problem, is the way that it overemphasizes swing states. I think people have this idea that Donald Trump managed a an Electoral College win without a popular vote win because he had a small state advantage, but that's not really true. There are a lot of small Democratic states, Vermont, Delaware, Rhode Island, that sort of thing. What Trump did that gave him a big advantage in the Electoral College is he won a lot of large states by very small margins, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, Florida. And you can have that happen the other way. You did have a big Electoral College advantage for Obama in 2012 over Mitt Romney. In 2004, when Democrats were so upset about the vote count in Ohio, if John Kerry had pulled it out in Ohio, he would have been winning the Electoral College, but despite losing the popular vote by a substantial margin to George Bush. And my question to Rich is, why is any of this a desirable system? Why should a place like, you know, it was Ohio 20 years ago, now it's Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Arizona, why should those states be more important than either red states like Kansas or blue states like California?
Well, one, those states do change. They don't stay the same all the time. And this time around, you know, we'll have battleground states in Michigan and Wisconsin, at least probably we will. And no one would have thought that's possible prior to 2016. So it does swing around a little bit. And the alternative is to have an election that is dominated by the big states. And what Trump did was hold Republican states, and then find a way to have a new sort of appeal in a couple important states that tipped them over the top. Seems like that's a good thing, what you want candidates to do. And it shouldn't be beyond conceiving that Democrats once again find a way to get to 270. You know, it might mean moderating a little on cultural issues or thinking more about how you appeal to the Rust Belt or the white working class. And I think the Electoral College, the feeling against the Electoral College is just a misdirection, a way to avoid thinking about the perhaps more uncomfortable conversation about how you actually have a geographically distributed coalition again, which, again, you know, wasn't long ago when Barack Obama did it. Some Democrat conceivably can do it again.
Yeah, Liz, this is what worries me most about the level of discussion about the Electoral College change. I mean, first of all, it's not going to happen. You'd have to amend the Constitution. This national popular vote compact thing doesn't work because imagine trying to enforce that on the states in an election where it actually matters for the outcome. And so it's a lot of time devoted to a political change that won't happen. And then the other thing is, I think that, you know, approximately even in the Electoral College system, the way to win the presidency is by getting the most votes. If Hillary Clinton had done very slightly better, she would have won the presidency through the Electoral College. And it feels to me like taking the focus off the thing that you do in order to get more votes than you did last time, to get more votes than your opponent, is likely to take your focus away from the thing that actually gets you the presidency.
Yeah, I mean, I think that having the discussion about the Electoral College and the sort of many manifold difficulties with our electoral system early in the primary, when candidates are introducing themselves and sort of providing their perspective on the American situation as a whole, is a perfectly fine conversation to have and a perfectly good time to have it. Obviously, no one's going to make it the centerpiece of their campaign for precisely the reasons you outline. And I would hope that it doesn't cause any particular candidate or their base to believe that there is an easy shortcut type way to have permanent Democratic hegemony in the White House, right? There is no easy shortcut way to do it. You just have to win the votes. You're going to have to win an election. I've said that since the beginning, you know, with the Democratic insistence on impeachment, for example. That always seemed to me to be a fantasy about being able to get a Democrat in the White House without winning an election. And this can feel a little bit similar. Again, I think it's a reasonable conversation and a good point to raise. But Democrats can't shy away from the fact that they're going to have to win a presidential election. And focusing on how they can pull those voters in the Midwest that went from Obama to Trump back to the Democrats is a good use of time, I think.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Liz Brunig, what's your rant?
So there are a couple of new documentaries out on Elizabeth Holmes. My first complaint about her is the most serious one, and that is that she didn't just rip off investors with Theranos, the blood testing company that turned out to be bogus. She also put consumers in serious harm. At the same time, I'm bothered by the fact that she's getting all of the bad rap for being a terrible person who created a fraudulent company, ripped off investors, and put consumers at harm, when that's pretty normal for the run of capitalism.
Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
The Southern Poverty Law Center fired its co-founder, Morris Deves, without a lot of explanation, but with a suggestion that he'd created a hostile work environment. The SPLC, which uses its reputation as a civil rights organization as a shield, has for years now been a fundraising juggernaut that recklessly names people and organizations it disagrees with as hate groups. The designations are then repeated endlessly in a credulous press. Hopefully, the D's firing is the beginning of more media skepticism about this pathetic, poisonous, money-grubbing operation.
For my rant, I also wrote this week about the new Theranos documentary by Alex Gibney for HBO. And the thing that always sticks out to me about Theranos is that the company sort of came to public attention in around, 2013-ish. The Wall Street Journal reveals that the product doesn't work and they've been doing unreliable blood tests in 2015. And by 2017, the company has imploded. But as you see in the book, Bad Blood by John Carreyrou, the Wall Street Journal reporter who exposed the company, all the way back in 2006, Elizabeth Holmes was doing fraudulent presentations for investors, fooling them about the nature of her technology in order to get them to invest in her company. And so I think a lot of the narrative around Theranos has Elizabeth Holmes as somebody who just got carried away, that she thought she was going to build this world-changing blood testing technology that worked on tiny droplets of blood, and that it just got out ahead of her. She wasn't able to make the technology work in time for it to work in the market. I don't think that's true. I think she's someone who is just lying all the way through. And I disagree with Liz about this being a hallmark of capitalism. Most companies have products. Like, you can argue about whether the products are good, whether they're sold in an ethical manner. Theranos didn't have a product at all. I find it amazing that it was able to go on and get so much investor support over a decade, and that it was able to actually get into Walgreens stores and be used on unsuspecting customers. It was horrible and immoral and requires the attention of the justice system. But I don't think that it is typical of capitalism. That is all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Liz Brunig, and Erica Greider. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Berskins and Colin Cab Washington are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.